Matthew chapter 5 in our journey through the teachings of Messiah as portrayed in the book of Matthew. Someone asked me recently if there were actually legitimate other gospels. And I found a note this week from a teacher of mine back some years ago, pointed out that in the first century, there you can find lists of 40 different lists of what the Gospels included. And in only one of those 40 discussions or lists of the gospel books, what we now know as the four, John, Mark, Luke, and Matthew, only one of those lists included any other gospel besides those four. And by the end of the second century, within, therefore, 150 years of the execution of Messiah, there are four Gospels that are known and only four. In other words, the four that we have were the four, nothing else was recognized among the believers in the early community of Messiah. Matthew has prominence of place by being the first. And we come today to the section where Messiah is going to compare and contrast traditions about the commandments with his tradition about how to live, literally how to walk. Our walk with God in Jewish terms, the halakha, the commandments, it's understood, but really it's that same old thing. Your word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my walk. We live by the commandments. They are our lifestyle. They are our, Psalm 119 even calls it our song. The commandments of the Lord. Better than pure honey, from the honeycomb even, Psalm 19 says. We come to the heart of Messiah's teaching, and he spends a really long time talking about this theme. He's going to say 8 times, "But I tell you," and he's going to elucidate the teachings, and as we talked about last week, how they come to their fullest height. Messiah did not come to abolish the Torah. He came to fulfill them, which means Messiah doesn't do away with the commandments. He brings them to their fullest. And we're going to see that unfold in 6 different ways. I'd like your help in doing this. Beginning in verse 21, could I have someone read down through verse 26, 21 through 26? Nobody? Okay, you have heard it said to those of old, "You shall not murder, but whoever commits murder will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. And whoever says to his brother, airhead, will be subject to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be subject to Gehenna. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering upon the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, then come present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent while you are with him on the way. Otherwise, your opponent may hand you over to the judge to the assistant, and you'll be thrown into prison. Amen, I tell you, you'll never get out of there until you've paid back the last penny. The unit of measure here for penny is one of the smallest references to a Roman coin. It would be the wages for a day laborer after just a few minutes' work. And so it's a penny is a good translation. Messiah is expanding on the commandment, don't kill. But along with Jewish tradition, he recognizes that there's a much deeper, broader understanding of what it means to murder someone. You've heard it said, don't murder. He says, you know that whoever does is subject to judgment. Premeditated murder in ancient Israeli culture brought the death penalty. But Yeshua steps back and he talks about anger. Anyone angry with his brother is subject to judgment. The same thing for being angry? I've probably been guilty this week. Sometimes, in a personal note, when I get together with my sister, some of those old sibling rivalries, you know, stick their heads up, and even here in middle life, you know, sometimes after spending a week together, which I'm going to be doing with my sister next month, the frustration, you know, especially in the kitchen, can pop up. Yeshua points out that at the root of murder, we have anger. We have coarse jesting and biting words. Not only anger, but he says, whoever says to his brother, oh, you fool, or fill in the blank of whatever that means in your context. I like this idea about calling someone an empty head, an airhead. I have to laugh. When I read this translation of airhead, I thought, I've not heard that phrase since like junior high. But here it is in a translation of Matthew. Not only anger, but even biting words, Yeshua says, you're subject to Gehenna for that. And so Yeshua gives us a response, a corrective. And he's teaching that reconciliation is greater than worship. Reconciliation is more important than prayer. Reconciliation is more important than attending synagogue on Shabbat. He says, leave your offering at the altar, and this is temple language. Turn around, walk out, and go make things right. He says, do it quickly. And here's the example to add force to Yeshua's words. There may not be as much time as you think. Make friends quickly with your opponent. Otherwise, he might call in the guys in blue. He might call in the guy in the black robe. Pick your color. But Yeshua says, reconciliation is not only more important than worship, it may even save your life. Otherwise, he says, you might get thrown in prison. You won't be able to pay back the least penny. Yeshua takes the commandment and he fleshes it out and he raises these themes up. In Jewish tradition, elsewhere in Jewish tradition, it tells us that even to embarrass someone in public is as if you have murdered them. You get embarrassed, you blush, you turn red in the face. What color is blood? Blood is red. Blushing is red. Embarrassing someone, causing them to blush, is murder because you've brought the red. So Yeshua says, but I tell you. Could I have someone read 27 through 30? Thank you. Another discussion about a command. You have heard it said, but I tell you. And again, he's going to circumvent our excuses that says, I don't do that. I've never done this. This isn't me, but yet he cuts to the heart. Adultery was a major issue in the ancient Israeli culture. In fact, it was said to be one of the reasons that the first temple was God allowed the first temple to be destroyed, along with murder, was inappropriate sexuality. Yeshua, again, cuts down our defenses and our smugness, and brings it right between our ears. He says lust is adultery. Not merely the physical act, but the craving, the desire, the coveting. One of the commands, number 10 on the 10 words, says, don't covet. It's really easy to define murder. It's really easy to see someone who has made a false oath in court, if it can be found out. How do you gauge someone's coveting? Number 10 on the list is really not so obvious. It's something internal. It's something that's not done by external actions, at least at first. And Yeshua uses this same term, whoever looks on a woman, the force of the language is placed on the man, to lust after her, to covet her, has already committed adultery. I don't have my row of young people here today. I remember when I was a youth going, oh golly, I think I break that every day. We're not taught, but I was comforted when I realized this isn't talking about attraction. After all, in today's world where people arrange their own marriages without the direct guidance by parents, if we didn't have attraction, there wouldn't ever be any marriage. This is talking about something different. This is talking about a thoughtful, I don't even want to describe what it's talking about. Thoughts and thinking, meditation, a lingering desire is adultery, the act itself. Yeshua has a remedy for this one too. With murder, he said, go make it right. With this one, he says, cut your hand off. Pluck your eye out. Of course, Yeshua is an expert in hyperbole. We've seen it already in Messiah's teaching in the book of Matthew, and it won't be the last time. In fact, it won't be the last time hyperbole comes up. It'll come up again in about 10 minutes. Unfortunately, I actually met a man, walked into our service here one time, and then another time he came to one of our congregational sponsored conference events, who had actually said he made himself blind, and he quoted this verse. I'm not sure I actually believed him. He was of the disposition that I felt like he was trying to talk smack or something. But Yeshua says in very hyperbolic language, if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better that part is destroyed then the whole is destroyed. I also want to point out something here. Yeshua, when it comes to this, Yeshua places the emphasis and the blame squarely on the perpetrator. Although sometimes in our culture, you will hear the phrase, a rapist will say, she was asking for it, for whatever reason. Yeshua would never have consented to that argument. Yeshua firmly places the wrong on the person doing the action. The next paragraph is actually part of the same. Could someone read 31 and 32?
It was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery.
So this is really a pair with the one on committing adultery, and that's divorce. If coveting and craving another's sexuality is wrong, divorce is simply the same thing on a continuum. Divorce is, Yeshua says, adultery as well. The permanence of marriage in God's eyes endures. Yeshua does make a caveat, as does, this is one of six passages in the Messianic writings that speak about divorce. There's a number of places that there are caveats to divorce. But there's also a number of places where, in this case, it's Rabbi Paul says that brings up an example and says, in this case, maybe I wouldn't recommend divorce. And that's even in the case where a believer is married to a non-believer. Does that warrant divorce? And Shaul says, no. As long as the unbelieving spouse doesn't abandon the believing spouse, he says, I don't think that divorce should rule in this situation. It's a touchy topic. Basically because divorce has been enfranchised as an acceptable moral failing. Of course, in our culture, but even within our circles in the body of Messiah. About 25 years ago, when I was in seminary, I recall my uncle making a statement. He said, I have an idea for you for a project, for a paper you could write. He said, you know, when I was growing up, divorce was viewed with dishonor. It was something very sad, something regretted, something to be avoided. if at all possible. And he said, but now it's become, and this was in the 90s, he said, now it's become acceptable and no one questions it, even within a religious framework. He said, so here's the topic for your paper. Now divorce has followed the culture right into our congregations. He said, the same thing will happen for homosexuality. It will in time be treated and thought of in the same way as divorce. And so we find ourselves there today. There's a major Christian group, denomination, that at their next annual meeting will likely have a split. It didn't happen this year, but in a couple years, it will likely happen again, and it will be over the ordination of homosexual pastors and unions and so forth. The word of mercy here, of course, is that Yeshua doesn't say that we are to go around breaking up second and third marriages. Elsewhere, very interestingly, Yeshua actually seemed to imply that he understood that marriage was dissolvable. In fact, he had a conversation with a woman that had been married and remarried, in fact, five times. So we don't, of course, go and break up second marriages or third marriages. Someone actually told me that they've heard of groups that do that. It would seem completely counter to and retroactive in a way. I really think that we need to uphold the beauty, the sanctity, the holiness of marriage. And in few cases, given adultery, abandonment, abuse, physical, emotional abuse, that we need to combat the prevalence of divorce in our culture and in our religious communities. Could I have someone read verse 33 through 37? Okay. Again, I tell you, it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but you will carry out your oaths to Adonai. But I tell you, don't swear at all, not by heaven, for it is the throne of God, not by the earth, for it is the footstool for his feet, nor by Jerusalem, it is the city of the great king. Nor do you swear by your head, for you cannot make a single hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Anything more than this is from the evil one. Wow. From the evil one. It's quite an assertion. A false oath, not maintaining our word, is collusion with the evil one. Very interestingly, both Josephus and Philo, who were first century Jewish contemporaries, roughly contemporaries of Messiah, stated in their writings that the Essene community, which was one of many different groups within Jewish culture, the Essenes could be trusted. The Essenes never used an oath because their word could be trusted. Their word could be honored. Yeshua says, because when we make an oath, Yeshua says, ultimately we are implicating God in our oath. He says, don't swear by anything, and he starts out by mentioning God. He says, not by heaven, for it is the throne of God. Of course, in the book of Matthew, when Matthew mentions heaven, it's a circular way of him referring to God. For instance, the kingdom of heaven in Matthew is the same thing as the kingdom of God. Matthew is saying oaths first and primarily implicate God. Rather, it's stated or not stated, even if you're making the oath based on your own hair, which I'll have to study that one a little bit more. I don't understand that one yet. You can't make it white or black. The command in the Torah went like this. Don't misuse the name of God when you are swearing, which really isn't necessarily about four-letter words. It's more about our statements. It's more about our reports, our testimonies. Think of a courtroom scene, making a false testimony. But when we do that falsely, we are dragging God into our sin. That commandment in the 10 words is about not dragging God into our lie, into our false report. Why would we want to drag God's name through the mud? Yeshua says we protect that from happening by simply being people of integrity. Ari Sokaram, one of the Israeli pioneers in messianic leadership, he's actually, he's not deceased. A number of years ago, he passed on his congregation to someone else. But I heard him speak. I've heard him speak numerous times, and he's always has wisdom. One time he said, here are the three most important things that I look for in people, particularly people that I work with and associate with. He said, here are the top three things. He said, the first thing is integrity. He said, number two is integrity. And number three is integrity. I think Yeshua would say the same thing, because anything more than this is from the evil one. Let your yes be yes and your no, no. One of my teachers, former teachers, that I took a, actually it was a study of Matthew, many years ago with Craig Keener. Keener said that we should be like either a horse or a rider. We should say nay or yay. Okay, that was a bad joke, I know. You know, the horse says nay, and the rider says yay. So, yes and no. Be like a horse or be like the rider. I'm not going to get through the last two of these today, so we will have to put these off for next time. I want to go to verse 48. Verse 48 is the conclusion of this section. Yeshua says, therefore, be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Ultimately, in all of these examples, Messiah has given various examples about, in some cases, kind of overstatement or being speaking hyperbole, cutting out your eye or so forth. In all of these examples, they pale in the ultimate example. Yeshua says the ultimate example is to be the Most High Himself. Imitate the Father. Your Father in heaven. What Yeshua is speaking of is what we call holiness. It is choosing the path of separation to God. I had a Jewish friend who challenged me. In fact, he really liked to bring this up. The fact that the Gospels tell us we have to be perfect. His comment was that not even the Torah ever says that. But I disagree. While he was playing semantics, the word in Hebrew that would be translated perfect is actually a word that means whole, wholehearted, wholesome. In fact, it appears in this week's Torah portion, speaking of Jacob. In chapter 25 of Genesis, it says that he was a ish tam. He was a wholesome man. That's the translation of the in the art scroll Siddur. Excuse me, the art scroll Chumash. Messiah is in line and continuity with the scriptural tradition. Be wholesome. Be holy. Like your Father in heaven. And Yeshua here is making one other contrast. Back in verse 20, he says, unless your righteousness exceeds the Pharisees and the Torah scholars, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Here he says, follow the example of the Father in heaven. Our example comes from him. Our example does not come from any other teacher, religious or otherwise. It ultimately comes from the Father himself. It is God's righteousness that we pursue. It is his example that we endeavor to hold on to. And from here, in chapter 6, Matthew will discuss the righteousness in concrete ways that we can cultivate in our life. You can read ahead, and we'll discuss it in the upcoming weeks. My simple prayer is that for all of us as a community, that first of all, we'd recognize, number one, the authority of Messiah. Note that he said, you've heard it said, people have said this and that, whatever it is. Yeshua says, but I tell you, but I tell you. About 8 times he uses that phrase in chapter 5. Yeshua is our authority. Not any other organization, leader. Yeshua is our authority. Interestingly, in Jewish tradition, very often, the authority would be handed down. You would make your statements in the name of or in the authority of previous experts, either your teachers or your teachers' teachers. Yeshua not once ever did that. That's why later it's going to be said, wow, the crowd says, wow, he has such authority, quite unlike the Torah scholars. So that's point number one in application. Recognize the authority of Yeshua in the life of our congregation. And number two, Yeshua calls us to nothing less than complete holiness in our lives. And while we are probably going to struggle in 1, 2, or 15 different ways, we pursue the righteousness from God. If you stand, I want you to stand on the... Now you made me laugh and I forgot. I forgot my line. If you stand on the promise that God will pull you through. And if you fall on the mercy that has brought you thus far to this day. So that rather by strength or our struggle, rather by standing or falling, we find ourselves enveloped in God's presence to move forward. We pursue righteousness. We desire holiness. We let him build that in us. We give each other grace so that God can build it in them. And together we run the race for Yeshua.